Artificial intelligence in the courtroom is under scrutiny. The Ohio Board of Professional Conduct published new guidance for legal professionals on using AI, and lawyers in other states have been disciplined for using AI-generated made-up citations in legal briefs. So what's the right approach for lawyers and their clients? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss how legal professionals are using AI, the benefits and the risks, are Wood, Heron & Evans partner Tom Humphrey and Bricker, Graydon & Wyatt, LLP practice support director Michael Stack. Thank you both for being here today.
Morning.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Michael, how are lawyers at your firm using AI?
At Bricker, Graydon & Wyatt, we have an incredible number of use cases. Anything from administrative work, which is really the low-hanging fruit that I think a lot of attorneys can start with to get value out of artificial intelligence, creating billing descriptions for client bills, helping summarize industry articles, helping draft emails. The goal is to really start with some of those low-value, low-hanging fruit, repetitive tasks in order to get value for the attorneys and free up time so that they can focus on strategy that attorneys are being paid to provide for clients.
Yeah, all that brain work. Yeah. Tom, what about you? How do you personally use AI as an attorney?
Primary use case for me is evaluation of work product that I'm generating for the sake of consistency, consistency with source documents or self-consistency, which I think in all legal work, using the same word for the same thing comes up all the time. And as you revise a document, you wind up with inconsistencies that can be seen if you can just read the English language and maintain memory of everything that was there before. But it's very hard as a human being to actually maintain that. And so that's an obvious one. But in our practice, which is in intellectual property, we are frequently receiving technical documentation and needing to have a consistency between that and the material that we generate and submit to the patent office. And I think that is where, and we're really in an evaluation stage where we have licensed multiple candidate AI engines and are evaluating their ability to process specifically technological information and do assessments for consistency or summarization. And that's the key area for us right
so
now.
So you're sort of test driving several different AI
Several
products.
Different test drives are underway actively.
Yeah. Well, Michael, I've read that some lawyers start out wanting to use AI to automate kind of the quote-unquote easy parts of the job. But depending on what they do, that approach can make the hard parts even harder. What have you observed at your firm?
Yeah, I think one of the initial hurdles with the use of AI, and to be clear, I think what we're really talking about here is generative AI. AI as a term has been around for a long time. It's a very broad umbrella term. And I think generative AI, creating new content based on training data, is really what is at the heart of the issues facing attorneys today. And I think one of the initial hurdles to implementation of AI in an effective and ethical manner is really getting over the mysticism of AI. We're almost 4 years out after, you know, ChatGPT took over the world in fall of 2022, and there's still a gap in AI literacy, in understanding how AI works. What are the pros? What are the cons? What are the benefits? What are the risks? And that lack of understanding or perhaps fear of missing out on the new thing is what drives, I think, a lot of these ethical issues that attorneys are facing in the courts for the use of AI.
What do you mean by that?
For example, I would suspect that everyone who's in the legal industry has heard of the 2023 case in the Southern District of New York, Matta versus Avianca. Very famous case where the two New York attorneys submitted hallucination-filled briefs to the court. And what I think the key understanding from that case is, number one, the attorneys didn't recognize the tool. Their excuse was, we didn't know that it would, you know, hallucinate, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm. Which is just making stuff up.
Making stuff up.
Yeah.
But, you know, we really peel back the layers there, and there's an understanding that artificial intelligence is still based on mathematical probability, not truth. And so step number one for attorneys is to recognize you have to understand the limitations of artificial intelligence in order to use it ethically and effectively. But more importantly in that case, and more importantly, I think, for attorneys who are looking to incorporate AI, in the Matta case, the attorneys lied to the court. You know, candor to the tribunal was really my key takeaway from that. Not only did they use the technology that they didn't understand, but they doubled down on their story with the court. And so step one is building AI literacy, this understanding of how the tools work so that you can understand the potential pitfalls. Only then can you implement them in an ethical and responsible way.
Yeah, the lie always gets you.
The lie always gets you.
Yeah. Well, Tom, does your firm have specific guidelines or rules related to using AI?
Yes. So the first rule is do not use AI in any work-related subject matter unless it's a firm-approved process and a firm-approved product. And that goes to the heart of another issue we haven't touched on, which is the necessary confidentiality and privileges that need to attach to attorney work. Confidentiality, I think, is easier to understand for the lay person. What you put into a website, especially a ChatGPT or another, where you might be producing entire paragraphs of content, is not under a licensing control or a confidentiality agreement. And you don't even have an agreement that it won't be used to train the AI that you're interacting with. So first and very simple rule is don't take content that you expect to be confidential and begin putting it into those places. Mm-hmm. So that's rule number one. But then there are also privilege issues around the unique attorney-client relationship that a client acquires when you seek out a licensed professional who is going to be your attorney. Your communication with them is privileged. It's not available for discovery or use against you. Your attorney's work product that they create as they're representing you and seeking to, you know, find the best answers for your problems is privileged, and it's not available to be used against you. Those rules all assume sort of traditional frameworks in which those works, pieces of work are done. Pieces of paper, reading books, typing into your own personal word processor, not going on a website and interacting with a potentially, you know,
sentient appearing machine.
So I think, actually the Ohio Board of Professional Conduct has really done a nice job in laying out really basic frameworks for maintaining client confidentiality, avoiding loss of privilege problems, and also, as Michael was talking about, understanding what AI can and cannot do. And as you know, the reason I led with document consistency, document summarization, is that at least gives the AI a cabined set of facts and asks it to compare these facts to these facts, which it's much better at than trying to reason toward what ought to exist or what ought to have been. And that's where the hallucinations come. And frankly, throughout the law, there are many things that ought to be and are not. That is actually the reason why we go to law school and then practice for so many years, is to understand how things are not the way you expect them. Mm-hmm. And explain to clients, well, it's not the way you expect because of this other reason, and trying to build a system around is very difficult. And that's where AI fails, because it builds what seems like the system and comes up with cases that seem like they ought to exist, but they don't.
Mm. Well, we're talking about how legal professionals are using artificial intelligence, the benefits and the risks. Do you have questions or comments? Call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. So, Michael, do lawyers at your firm disclose their use of AI to clients up front? What are the legal requirements there?
To provide a law school answer here, the answer is it depends. what we're seeing from clients, especially institutional clients that are more sophisticated, have their own in-house legal counsel teams, we're seeing in our outside counsel guidelines typically two buckets. We're seeing clients who for confidentiality reasons, for data privacy reasons, forbid us from using artificial intelligence. Mm. And so there's certainly a requirement, you know, to disclose to those clients what our AI acceptable use policies are, whether we use it, whether we don't. But we're also seeing a second bucket of clients who are actually requiring our attorneys to use artificial intelligence in their outside counsel guidelines. They see the potential efficiencies, the potential, we'll say, reduction of billable hours. Mm. And there are a few clients who are requiring us to use it specifically in legal research and that sort of use case. Mm-hmm. And so the range of clients that we have to disclose to is very wide. Another consideration that we have to keep in mind every day, especially in litigation, is there are always going to be standing court orders where judges around the nation, both in state and federal court, have decided attorneys shall or shall not use AI to draft briefs or motions that are going to be filed in their court. And so we have to track not only what our clients want, but what the courts want as well in each individual courtroom and act accordingly.
That sounds like a lot to keep track of. Well, we will continue our conversation after a short break, and later in the program, a film that takes viewers on a rockabilly road trip. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our conversation about how legal professionals are using AI. My guests are Bricker Graydon Wyatt, LLP Practice Support Director, Michael Stack, and Wood, Heron, and Evans partner, Tom Humphrey. You can join the conversation. Call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. So, Tom, how do paralegals feel about this, use of AI, and are they worried about their jobs? Can AI do some of the things that those professionals do?
Well, I think whatever worry there was about the computers altering the job of paralegals would have been about 20 years ago. I think in the last 20 years, and now I'm really specifically referring to the experience of an intellectual property law firm, which is what we are. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has substantially automated all of its mechanisms for filing. It has actually automated the generation of forms, almost all the forms that you might need for a trademark, and they've automated at least the filing for patent purposes. The Copyright Office has done the same. It's a completely electronic system. And we also, as an overlay of all of that, we have an entire licensed bundle of software that we utilize to generate form correspondence for the patent offices and also correspondence to opposing counsel and also billing. So all of those efficiencies have been built. I think if we were in a more generic practice that was trying to do all things for all people, we would be maybe struggling with having a form for things, and AI could really help us. But at this point, AI is more down into the substance of what we produce, mm-hmm. which is what I was just discussing before. Technological information, summarizing, just re-describing it, and then creating content that goes into all the forms I just described. And that's not really... That is a job of the attorneys. Mm-hmm. That is really ultimately a job of the attorneys and our professional illustrators.
Yeah.
It has been interesting with the professional illustrators. The question is, how much can AI do that replaces the professional illustrators? And the answer so far is not much at all. It's just not at all able to. A picture's worth 1,000 words. Well, it's actually worth more than 1,000 because you can't really describe a picture even with 1,000 words. Mm-hmm. This is what we're learning.
Yeah.
So that's what our experience is. It's enhancing what we do, but it's at the attorney, it's the highest professional credentialed levels.
Mm-hmm. What about at your firm, Michael? Are there jobs, whether it's a paralegal or some other kind of job, that where folks are worried, hey, will AI replace me?
I think it's fair to say the worry is across the legal industry. The potential effect that AI has on the billable hour, for example, for general purpose firms, is an existential dread. But I would give the same advice to an attorney as I would a paralegal or legal assistant. I think at least in the short to medium term, I don't think AI has the proper capability, given the way that the practice of law is run at any level, AI isn't going to come for our jobs in the short to medium term, but I think other attorneys who use AI, paralegals who use AI, legal assistants who use AI, will come for the jobs of those who don't.
Hmm.
I think it's impossible to ignore the efficiency gains and that, you know, hiring committees, HR departments, whether it's a private law firm, in-house counsel, insert your organization here, they're going to want folks who have skills in artificial intelligence, in maximizing efficiency, and also keeping in mind the potential assault on the billable hour in favor of, you know, potentially contingent fee agreements or alternative fee arrangements. That is on the hearts and minds of everyone in the legal industry.
Hmm. What about courtroom stenographers? Could they be replaced by AI? I don't spend a lot of time in courtrooms, so I don't know about that. But what do you think about that?
My short-term answer to that is, having seen some of the, for example, machine translation software that is out there and the accuracy rates of that software, I don't think the artificial intelligence algorithms and models are quite to a point where they are accurate enough to replace court stenographers. But I think given the nature of large language models, given the nature of how quickly artificial intelligence is gaining both in speed and efficacy and adoption, it's certainly a key area to watch out for.
Mm-hmm. Tom, I referenced this at the beginning of our conversation, but dozens of lawyers have been disciplined for using fictitious citations in legal briefs that were generated by AI, this hallucination stuff we've talked about. How important is it for human lawyers to check everything AI is churning out for them or doing for them?
I mean, it's absolutely fundamental to check. And frankly, we have software to do this, to take a brief and to go and find every citation in it. And we've had this for 20 years. Check every citation and every quote and make sure that it's real, that it actually is there and it is where you say it is. And it astonishes me that these things happen, but these things happen. And mm-hmm. I think Michael nailed it. It's a misunderstanding of what AI can and cannot do, and its likelihood to hallucinate or create where on basis of probability as opposed to fact.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is a human sort of nature process. I think we're all working to some extent in probability as we just go through our day. It's unlikely that car will pull out in front of me, right? It's unlikely the light will turn, you know, red in the next 5 seconds. This is how we reason our way through life. But in some of these domains, there either is or there isn't, right? And so in those domains, you know, the AI is not at the place where it understands, I can't just guess here, I need to know, right? And I think that's something that the rule of professional conduct takes up and does very well. And I think the other thing that it takes up that I wanted to point out is, clients need to understand that, you know, the AI is not an attorney. They tend to look at it and start having interactions with the AI as if they're seeking like preliminary legal advice. Well, there's a couple problems. Number one is probably not right. Then the other problem is now you've had an exchange of the kind that would have been privileged in a context where it is not privileged. Much better to call the attorney and have the entire interaction with the attorney's AI, you know, even with a microphone, so that now it's in the context of work product and communication with the attorney, than to just go to a website and try to get your preliminary legal advice, which I think for sure we'll eventually land at the place where a client's interaction with a publicly available or even their own private AI is not going to be privileged because it doesn't involve an attorney in the seeking of legal advice.
Yeah. Michael, what do you know about how judges and magistrates are using AI? Is there a lot of that happening?
My understanding is that, you know, talking to several members of the judiciary, talking to some of their staff, I think they're using it for a lot of the same use cases that attorneys are, helping them ideate, you know, potential legal reasoning, helping them synthesize briefs and motions, helping them do legal research. I think one of the key considerations for the judiciary, perhaps even more so than attorneys, is this inherent need for the judiciary to get it right, to be the arbiters and protectors of justice and fairness. And what I've seen in a lot of the large language models is a need to validate the argument that you're trying to make in your prompt. And so they almost naturally in their responses deviate to one direction or the other based on the direction they think you want them to go. And so I think it's even more important for the judiciary to recognize what AI is and isn't, and make sure that when they're using it to come to judicial decisions, that it's really their independent judgment that is ruling out at the end of the day.
Yeah. We've referenced this guidance from the Ohio Board of Professional Conduct that was developed at the request of the Ohio Supreme Court. And that guidance also says AI is best used by experienced judges or staff. What do you think of that, Tom? Is this not for newbies?
Well, I think it's not for AI newbies. I think that's really what they're getting at. And there is an interesting aspect of that guidance is that it leads with, this is a tool that's valuable and meaningful, and as a practicing attorney, just electing carte blanche not to use it may actually violate the obligation to practice efficiently and effectively for your clients. This is not an avoidable, right? So they say that, and then they immediately go into everything that can go wrong. So we're going to tell you, you probably ought to do it, and then here's all the things you really can't be doing.
Yeah.
And I do find interesting the billable hour, the almighty billable hour has come up here. And the guidance explains that one of the key points of disclosure to make to clients is if you're billing them by the hour, right, you have to continue to bill them by the hour. If the AI has made you more efficient, they should have the benefit of that because it's fewer hours. Otherwise, you need to make an alternative fee arrangement, which frankly, at least in my practice, there's been many, many alternative fee arrangements, packaging and bundling.
Yeah.
That is a key disclosure point also.
Yeah. Well, I have been talking with Wood, Heron & Evans partner Tom Humphrey and Bricker, Graydon, Wyatt, LLP practice support director Michael Stack. Thank you both so much for your time today and for this fascinating conversation.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Up next, a documentary that takes viewers on a rockabilly road trip and gets into the raw and relatable honky-tonk music. This is Cincinnati Edition.